This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Walter Benjamin's drift through Moscow is constant, physical, and enervating. Arriving at the sanatorium to visit Asya Lasis when she has just left, or at someone's home for dinner, only to hear from the man's wife that he has just gone out for the evening. Futile trips to museums that turn out to be closed. Getting lost in the cold on the way to the Tretyakov Gallery. Seemingly never getting to see the play or movie he was intending to see. Traveling in streetcars with iced over windows so that he can never see where he is. Foiled quests to obtain his precious wooden toys. Waiting, endlessly waiting, in rooms or on street corners for Asya and others. Pouting in his room, reading Proust and eating marzipan. This seemingly aimless drift through the streets and interiors of Moscow famously leads, however, to evocative observations of material culture that rub up against his own memories of other streets and spaces, gradually adding up to his theoretical proposition that in order to succeed, socialism in Russia must harness the collective fantasies lodged in both the wild profusion of consumer objects thrown up by NEP and the ascetic aspirations of the new Bolshevik culture and everyday life. The drift is intellectual as well as physical, as he wanders from meeting to meeting, holding inconclusive conversations with Soviet cultural characters he doesn't much like, limited in his perceptions by his lack of knowledge of language or context, and not to mention the endless, rarely satisfying conversations with Bernhard Reich and Asya Lasis about Russian culture under socialism. One day, December 18th, is particularly drifty. He changes money, shops for fabric with Asya, plays chess with Reich after lunch, goes to the Meyerhold Theater but can't get a ticket, tries to go to a movie but it's sold out, visits the apartment of a new acquaintance, goes back to the movie theater but the movie is so terrible that he leaves to go home before it's over. In the midst of all this inconclusivity, between the chess and the abortive trip to the Meyerhold Theater, he gets caught with his intellectual pants down, unready for an interview with a reporter that he should have prepared for. Since he had not pulled his thoughts together about how he would answer the obvious question put to him about what he, as a German leftist writer, was currently working on, he had to make something up. He tells the reporter that he wants to, quote, do a book dealing with art under dictatorships, Italian art under the fascist regime, and Russian art under the dictatorship of the proletariat. His invocation of dictatorship points us toward the strong counter-urge to drift that forms an equally powerful model of cultural action put forth in the diary. The fantasy that cultural production could be transformed into a unified shared project under party control. His proposition is startling in our current perception of art history. The term art under dictatorship has become a familiar subfield in the study of modern art. It has a negative cast. The term denotes the unpleasant but necessary task of studying the enemy of free modernist art. And it refers to art under individual murderous dictators, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, Mao, Ceausescu. It is also unexpected from a Marxist perspective because it pairs the dictatorship of the proletariat, the very form of government that Soviet Russia was ostensibly living under at that moment, and therefore a largely positive term for Benjamin and for the reporter interviewing him. It pairs that with the negative category of fascist dictatorship. The deliberate contrast, therefore, puts productive pressure on our current concept of art under dictatorship by suggesting that this is not necessarily a negative possibility. One could have, presumably, an oppressive arts administration under the dictatorship of the fascist regime in Italy, but then theoretically a productively unifying system of art production under the dictatorship of the Communist Party in the USSR. This particular topic of art under dictatorship does not come up again in the diary. Benjamin had, after all, made it up on the spot for the benefit of his interviewer. But a few weeks later, on January 8th, the diary returns to the role of the party in intellectual life. After describing another meandering day, an altercation with Reich in the morning about another political faux pas he had made at Dom Girzena, the home of VAP, the Association of Proletarian Writers, a thrown-together cold lunch alone in his room to avoid going to Dom Girzena, more games of dominoes, alone again in his room for the evening. After all of this, Benjamin concludes, "It is becoming clearer and clearer to me that my work needs some sort of solid framework, and that framework would be the party. Can the experimental left-wing writer be a force for socialist change within the party or without it?" Benjamin wonders as he rehearses the pros and cons. And so this is, of course, a famous passage from the diary, but I'll read it. "This is the question that, quote, so unconditionally forces one to take a position, that poses the dilemma as to whether one is going to remain in the hostile and exposed, uncomfortable and drafty spectator area, or whether one is going to adopt some sort of role in the commotion on the stage." Although ostensibly he is talking about the position of the Russian intelligentsia, those unkind adjectives also tell us about his perception of himself in Moscow, where he feels uncomfortable and exposed. He dreams of escaping the unstructured, hostile, and drafty spectator area and climbing up onto the stage where the directed action is taking place. He returns to this internal debate in the next diary entry, once again swaying back and forth between the pros and cons. Further considerations: join the party, clear advantages, a solid position, a mandate, even if only by implication. On the other hand, to be a communist in a state where the proletariat rules means completely giving up your private independence, the seductiveness of the role of the outrider. Within the party, the enormous advantage of being able to project your own thoughts into something like a pre-established force field. A force field is a metaphor, but it is also an image, and probably even a dialectical image, suggesting a bounded structure of pulsating lines of force that can catch you, hold you in your solid position, and give you your mandate. Unlike the outrider, who is spatially outside the field or off the stage, drifting on the margins.